You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs in for Carrie Miller. Many a young girl has dreamed of falling in love with a millionaire and living a life of luxury and leisure. For St. Paul native Joan Mansfield, that dream came true. But her story is far different from the typical fantasy. Joan married Ray Kroc, the man who turned McDonald's into one of the nation's most iconic brands. During their marriage and after his death, she became known for her incredible generosity, giving more than $200 million to National Public Radio and $2 billion to the Salvation Army, amongst other gifts. Joining me now is Lisa Napoli, author of Ray and Joan, the man who made the McDonald's fortune and the woman who gave it all away. Lisa, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, first off, why did you want to tell this story?
It's not because I'm a big McDonald's fan. It is sort of because I am a public radio reporter and have been for years. And like anybody who listens to public radio, particularly anybody who works in it, you got to wonder when you hear Joan Kroc's name said on the radio over and over again, why? Why was she so enamored? Or, I mean, you know why she was so enamored, because everybody loves public radio. But how did that come about? But specifically, there was a peace sculpture in Southern California, where I live, a 26-foot tall nuclear mushroom cloud made of chain link.
Oh my goodness.
And it turns out it was in disrepair a few years ago, and I went to cover this story, and it turned out that she had funded it, and it didn't make any sense to me that she had, because she didn't live anywhere near where I lived in Santa Monica. And so I just looked for a biography of this interesting woman and couldn't find one. So I spent the last 5 years working on one.
Well, congratulations on the publication of the novel. It's such an interesting story because they are such very different people.
Yeah.
And also you learn a lot about how the McDonald millions and billions were made. Ray, as a young businessman, was kind of an interesting character. He went around and tried a bunch of different things as a salesman and almost pyramid scheme stuff he had going on for a
mm-hmm.
while. Talk a
yes.
little bit about how Ray became Ray.
Yeah. And, you know, I wanted to write a book about Joan, but I realized I couldn't write about Joan without learning and writing about Ray and, of
mm-hmm.
course, McDonald's. So it turned out to be a fascinating exercise, because Ray was a classic journeyman. He actually started as a piano player, but he was a salesman and he sold paper cups and then multi-spindled milkshake machine mixers back when those things were really technological advances in society.
State of the art.
Helped.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were state of the art at the time. And he loved to sell. He was a classic traveling salesman. And he stumbled upon this idea in the desert of California while he was selling these milkshake machines. And that's what intrigued him about McDonald's and made him want to take it large. I didn't know any of that. I knew McDonald's, but it was fascinating to reverse engineer the history of McDonald's without, by the way, any help from McDonald's, which didn't cooperate
really?
With me on this book. Not at all. But what was so interesting is to learn about the landscape that allowed fast food to flourish. You know, we know it's an indelible part of life. Most of us don't particularly, well, I shouldn't say most of us. I know I don't particularly love fast food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Fast Food Nation is a wonderful book that explains all of that. But what I was interested in is how American society evolved or devolved, if you look at it that way, into this world where such things were possible. And it was all because of these two brothers who'd moved from New Hampshire to the desert of California, needed to make a living, started a hot dog stand, which morphed into a rib stand, which morphed into this very precision assembly line of food preparation that Ray Kroc from Chicago fell in love with and propagated all across the land with the help of some very, very, very smart business people.
Yeah, and that was an interesting thing to me, is that the brothers were not interested in franchising it. It was really Ray who was like, no, this could be the model for a national deal.
The brothers, this is a classic business story, right? The brothers were happy making good money with their one store in San Bernardino, California. They worked really hard, as anybody in the restaurant business typically does, and it was humming along. They were buying their new Cadillacs each year, and they were perfectly happy, and they knew it was a gigantic hassle to franchise. And Ray didn't mind that hassle, and in fact, he ran with it in such a way that he basically sort of obsessed absconded with the business, so to speak. I mean, it's much more complicated than that, mm-hmm. as is the relationship with Joan, which is what makes it so interesting, because, you know, we see McDonald's everywhere, but we never think about how it was this pull, this tug by this man to get these brothers to go in a direction they really didn't want to be bothered with.
And we're talking about Joan. She's a West St. Paul girl, grew up a daughter of a shopkeeper and a violin teacher. If I got that right?
Her father wasn't a shopkeeper. Oh, he was a railroad worker.
Okay. Yeah.
But modest means. Modest, exactly. Means.
And she also played the piano. I found that is sort of the interesting tie between the two of them, that they were both, musicians of a sort.
Yeah, and there was a time when learning piano was a skill that was something, people valued in a different way than they do today. And both, Ray and Joan were very skilled pianists. And in fact, they met because of music. Joan was playing the organ. She had three jobs. She was working at KSTP as an on-air piano player, back when that was how they filled the musical breaks and accompanied live programs in the 50s, in the earliest days of television.
We need to bring that back.
I know, right? It's so charming to think about that. And Ray playing in a hotel ballroom on the air when radio had no tape, but, no taped musical performance. But yeah, so Joan was playing live on the air. She was teaching, and she was also playing at the Criterion Restaurant, which some of your listeners may remember was on University Avenue. And it was an elegant, beautiful restaurant for the well-heeled. And she was playing organ in the dining room when Ray walked in to sell the owner of the restaurant, Jim Zine, a very well-regarded local businessman, a franchise of McDonald's. And Jim Zine's friends thought he was a little bit nuts for wanting to get into the hamburger racket. Hamburger stands were propagating all over the roadsides of America, the developing roadsides of America in the post-World War II landscape where suburbs were evolving. And he wanted in on the game. People couldn't understand it. And so he was given by Ray the opportunity, or he was sold the opportunity, to open store number 93 in St. Louis Park. And Joan was present the night they met. Ray was tantalized by her. And
the blonde beauty.
Blonde beauty playing this organ in the center of the dining room really well, which was something that was very alluring to him, not just her looks, but her proficiency. And all of a sudden, Joan's husband, her first husband, Raleigh, was being hired to run this McDonald's outpost in St. Louis Park. And the rest evolved over time and is history. So, yes, music united them throughout their lives and from the very start.
Yeah, they had quite the stormy romance. This was not the first relationship or first marriage for either of them. Talk a little bit about what Ray was dealing with and what she was dealing with.
Well, Ray was much older. He was 26 years older, and Joan was 28 when they first met. So he was running around the country desperately trying to bolster up this McDonald's idea. And while each individual McDonald's that was sold did well, usually, the corporate part was very, very precarious. In fact, it almost imploded a number of times. And so Ray was dealing with the stress of, in his early 50s, a business that was mounting debt and perhaps going to collapse. And his first wife, Ethel, his long-standing partner and mother of his only child, was stressed, to say the least, about this mountain of debt that they were living with, and the fact that this business could implode and really do them in. All the while Joan's first husband was first managing that St. Louis Park store and then earning the right to open his own McDonald's in Rapid City, South Dakota, where he and Joan moved with their young child at the time to start McDonald's in first McDonald's in the state of South Dakota. So it's an interesting parallel of their romance as they are both married to other people. Their McDonald's is booming and about to bust in some regards. And they had this volatility, both because they were married to other people and because Ray was such a ferocious and incredibly difficult person. So that's the sort of crux of the story, the parallel of the romance developing and the fits and starts. Joan was going to run off with Ray at one point. She did run off with Ray, and then she came back to her husband, and Ray divorced his first wife anyway, and in the meantime married someone else because he said he couldn't stand being a bachelor. And then Joan was ready years later to marry him, and off they went. And in the ensuing time, McDonald's went from this precarious business to being this publicly traded darling of both Wall Street and Ray being the celebrated capitalist in society. So it's a fascinating twin tale.
Well, you know, it's interesting when you have somebody who's 26 years younger, or you know, the young woman and the older wealthy man. Mm-hmm. Immediately, assumptions tend to go to, oh, well, obviously she's marrying for money. Right. Did you get an indication of what that dynamic was between the two of them? I mean, the fact that he's getting richer and wealthier, and she's like, okay, I'm marrying you. Was there a sense that the money played a part, or was this simply a really strong affair, or a real romance?
I think it was more of a real romance, and I think it really was that Joan thought big. Joan always had this ambition that was greater than her own sort of immediate world, and not just in the financial sense. I think that she wanted to live and be part of the world bigger than where she was in Rapid City. So Ray clearly was smitten, taken by Joan from the minute they met, and he was taken by her passion and her fiery personality. So I think many of the people that I've talked to in the writing of this book have said it's easy to say, yes, you know, older woman, older man, younger woman, money. But I think it was more complicated than that. And by the time that Joan did marry Ray, her first husband was doing quite well himself. He was not in the stratosphere of Ray, but they had moved up in society, or at least economically, in a way that they had not started out their lives together. So I think it's much more complicated than that. And that's what made it, as a biographer, such an interesting challenge, because it wasn't so black and white.
Yeah. And also, now, once they were married, there are some other issues that arise here. First off, politically, they weren't necessarily the same. He was much more conservative than she was.
Yes, yes. Ray called Joan a patsy because Joan was one of those people who, you know, conservative people might call a bleeding heart. She couldn't see someone suffering without wanting to intervene. And, of course, she, over time, inherited the money to be able to respond in a different way than most of us do when we have a bleeding heart about somebody who is suffering and have compassion for them. But yes, so their politics were different. And Ray was a ferocious drinker. He was ferocious without the drink. But when he did start drinking, he became in what Joan described, had a violent and ungovernable temper. And instead of divorcing him, and I think this is really telling about her personality, instead of divorcing him, which she did try to do, she filed for divorce early on in their marriage, she stayed and she started an alcoholism education charity, which was really much more than something that doled out money, which is why I was so compelled to investigate her life. Nothing wrong with writing checks. I love when people write checks when they have big bucks. It's fantastic. I think it's your moral right, moral obligation. But Joan was much more involved. And what she did, besides funding Hazelden, which is in your area, a preeminent organization on the forefront of addiction treatment,
right,
she created movies. She saw media the way McDonald's saw media, as a way into the American public's pocketbook and stomach. She saw media as a way into describing to people what addiction was, giving it a name, and showing people that they could get help. And so she convened addiction specialists in the 70s, at a time when this was not something commonly spoken about. And she hired filmmakers who hired top-notch actors, and they made films that aired on television nationally, and they published books that were distributed nationally, mostly for free, to get the word out about this problem, which was something that wasn't named as publicly as we know it today. And I find that such a fascinating turn for her. Instead of looking at how just to solve her own problem, she looked at how to turn her pain into something that was useful for the world at large. And that pain was something with Ray that was so interesting, because Ray didn't believe that he had a drinking problem, but he was enormously supportive of Joan and her efforts with this thing she called Operation Cork, Croc spelled backwards. So when I learned all of that about her, it just gave such dimension and such an interesting foray for a woman with a high school education who was not a social worker, not an addiction counselor, to have the foresight and the insight to develop something like this and use the money that she had at her disposal in Ray's foundation at the time to do this work. Gosh, how could you not love somebody like that?
You're listening to NPR News. I'm Marianne Combs. And this hour, we're talking with Lisa Napoli. She's the author of Ray and Joan, the story of Ray and Joan Croc. And, you know, we talked lightly a moment ago about politics and the fact that she was sort of a bleeding heart and that Ray called her a patsy. Did that keep her from, she demurred a little bit while he was still alive, but was she still actively expressing her opinions in other ways or making contributions to causes that he wouldn't necessarily be thrilled with?
Not while he was alive.
Really?
She did this Operation Cork effort, but she said in an interview in the early 80s in San Diego, where they wound up living, that she had kept her politics at bay while her husband was alive because she felt that it would be disrespectful, which is strange because she didn't seem to fear speaking out, and she certainly wasn't afraid to speak out about this problem that she never named Ray, but she was talking very openly about addiction. So it's a very curious juxtaposition. Mm-hmm. But later, after Ray died, she gave the first $1 million gift from an individual to the Democratic Party. And she became very politically involved in the sense of as a no-nukes activist. Mm. And those were things that probably Ray would not have cottoned well to. And what's interesting, too, I think all the time now about our politics, you just had a whole conversation about
right.
this. She was a fierce supporter of women in power, and you know, who knows how that would have manifested itself with our recent political election. But she was very interested in causes that probably were things that Ray would not have been so keen on.
How did family and corporate colleagues, you know, the sort of the NPR, the McDonald's brand, respond to this when she suddenly, you know, sort of came out of the closet and started giving money to these liberal causes?
You know, I talked to a lot of the old guard McDonald's franchisees, the ones who would talk to me were usually pretty disparaging and dismissive of Joan. I think they were more old guard conservative guys who just saw Joan as loose cannon and going down a path that they felt might have offended Ray. I don't think that was her MO. I don't think she wanted to offend Ray. I think she was just left all this money, and she was relatively young when Ray died. She was 55, and she just flourished as a philanthropic person. The first act that she did when Ray died broadsided McDonald's. There was a terrible incident the year Ray died, 1984, where someone walked into a McDonald's in San Ysidro, not far from where she lived.
Oh, I remember this.
Yeah, it was the worst massacre of its kind at the time, worst mass shooting.
Yeah.
And Joan, without even calling McDonald's, as the largest individual shareholder in McDonald's by Ray's death, she had inherited his position. She stepped forward and started this victims fund immediately without even talking to anybody. And that, you know, that McDonald's followed suit and put money in the pot as well. But Joan just really asserted herself as an independent person. And, you know, a big corporation with somebody asserting themselves, especially if it's a woman, Joan called McDonald's a chauvinistic corporation, even though she, of course, had affection for it, for what it had done for both of her husbands. It's an interesting position that she was put in, especially at that moment in time.
Mm. The fact, you know, she's such an interesting character. Aside from her bleeding heart generosity, the or I shouldn't call it bleeding heart generosity because that's how it was said disparagingly, but you know, her,
right.
In addition to her amazing generosity, she was just a character. She liked nice things. She did not refrain from treating herself while she was doing all this good work. She had a private jet.
Yeah. She loved her jet. Apparently, that was her prized possession because she used it to ferry people and animals in need of treatment, and in several cases, bodies of people who had died, friends of hers who needed to come back to their final resting place. She used that jet the way you would use your, you know, car when you're in high school and you want to ferry your friends around to parties. And that, I love the spirit, the joie de vivre that she had. And yes, at the same time that she was doling out money early in the AIDS epidemic to research or to individuals who were impacted by the AIDS crisis, or to a woman she met on a plane who wanted to build the first freestanding hospice in San Diego. So Joan just wrote her a check and went through a lot of hassles bureaucratically to get this woman the land so she could build the facility. Time and again, she did that kind of reactive philanthropy. You have something cool you want to do. It's going to help people. I'll help you out. At the same time, she was buying jewels, and she had an incredible art collection.
Mm-hmm.
She built this spectacular home for herself after Ray died in a very beautiful part of North County, San Diego, and this jet. So I love that juxtaposition as well. You know, I think it says a lot about her. She lived large, and yet it was overwhelming to her, apparently, till even the end of her life, that she had all of this money at her disposal. It's hard for us to imagine what that's like. You know, we can fantasize, as you said at the beginning, but when you're really put in that position, I think it was slightly unfathomable to her, and she managed to grasp with it in a really, I think, interesting way. There's this movie coming out about McDonald's next month, and it's about the first 5 years of McDonald's. But really, the movie, to me, is about Joan, because she's such a wonderful, larger-than-life character.
And even while she had that jet and that amazing, you know, Fabergé egg and other jewels in her collection, she was driving to the drive-through window of McDonald's to buy breakfast in the morning.
Yes, that is what's so great. You know, she would rail against McDonald's for being chauvinistic, but she went there and she'd either forget her purse or she'd give somebody a $100 tip. And she never expected anybody to know who she was. So she just had this sort of zaniness about her. She was an inveterate gambler, apparently. But she'd also sometimes just go to sleep very early in the evening with the salad. So she is, one person in San Diego told me how she used to get together with girlfriends and call those crazy 900 astrology hotlines just for fun. So she knew how to have fun. She knew how to live, and she had the means to do it. And at the same time, more importantly to me is that she, or as importantly, is that she gave so much money. And certainly at the end of her life, she gave it all, mostly all of it away.
Why, you mentioned earlier that McDonald's didn't want to grant you access, that they have not cooperated in this project. Why?
You know, I don't know for sure. I can only guess. But McDonald's is famously, it's famously documented that McDonald's doesn't like to open up what apparently is quite a formidable archive to outside individuals. I mean, Joan, while she was doing all of this radical, ecstatic giving later in her life, was not affiliated with McDonald's any longer. I mean, over time, she sold off her interests, much of her interest in the company that she'd inherited from Ray. And she was never acting on behalf of the company. She never asserted any sort of authority in the company. So she really was acting separately, even though, of course, she was indelibly entwined with them, given the source of the money. So McDonald's is just ferociously not interested in helping outside researchers. And I guess I was in that category.
What were you most surprised or intrigued by in researching this story?
Oh, my goodness. Every day was an awakening, a fascinating exercise in research. It took me to so many interesting places like Minneapolis, St. Paul, like Rapid City. I think, you know, the day that I got the divorce papers, I had read in an item in a newspaper from 1971 that Joan had filed for divorce. And I had known about this Operation Cork that she'd started and the movies. I hadn't found the movies. When I found the the divorce filing. And sitting on the floor in my little home office and reading through the divorce filing, I just felt such sadness about their situation, because Ray did love her so much and he was such a larger than life person and he was volatile too. Every day was a surprise with Joan, and it has been since this book came out a few weeks ago. I've gotten emails about things that she financed that I didn't even know about, and I think that's the pervasive wonder of her, is this openness, this spirit, and this heart and generosity. I've just kept thinking it was such an important story to tell, that a woman would do this with this money, that McDonald's is such a polarizing company, that she took this money and did so many amazing things with it. And I guess just everything about her has mesmerized me for years.
What do you think, of all of her gifts, which one do you think had the most impact?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, if you're a couple of people running a laundry for people suffering from AIDS in San Diego, and you get $500,000 that allows you to upgrade your equipment, your machines, that's a transformative gift. And if you're NPR and you get this $200+ million gift that you weren't expecting to get, that basically writes your financial issues in one fell swoop, that's a transformative gift. And if you're the Salvation Army and you're given this gift, and the mandate with that gift is you build recreation centers and poor neighbors around the country, even though that's not your stock and trade, that's a transformative gift. So
right.
I think every gift she gave had an indelible impact on the people who were, one of my favorite stories is this little boy in Tennessee in the early part of the AIDS epidemic, hemophiliac, contracted AIDS, needed a tutor to go to school because people didn't want him mixing with the kids in regular classes because they felt he would infect them. And the school district was about to go bust, didn't have the money, and they were going to have to fire his tutor. And Joan swept in, balanced the books of the school district, flew the boy on her plane out to San Diego, let him throw out the first ball at a Padres game. She inherited the San Diego Padres when her husband died. Stories like that, time and time again, they're just amazing.
Fabulous.
Amazing.
Lisa Napoli, I'm so sorry we've run out of time, but I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us. Really, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Lisa Napoli is the author of Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away.